Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. What happens when we look at matters of love, courtship, sex, and marriage through the lens of market forces like supply and demand? It's fascinating how the dynamics of sex and love can be analyzed using research and economic analysis to reveal how central the interplay of libido, gender, love, power, and economic forces are to the most important personal choices we make in our lives. Our guest today is Dr. Marina Adshade, author of the book Dollars and Sex: How Economics Influences Sex and Love. Dr. Adshade has spent the last 10 years teaching economics and engaging in original economic research. In 2008, she launched an undergraduate course titled Economics of Sex and Love, which invited her students to approach questions of sex and love through an economist's lens. The class was an immediate hit with students, and by the time the first term started, had generated international media attention. She has a PhD from Queen's University and currently teaches at the Vancouver School of Economics at the University of British Columbia. As a writer, Dr. Adshade hit her groove the moment she launched Dollars and Sex on the online knowledge forum, Big Think, and almost immediately became one of the best read series on that site, attracting over 750,000 unique visitors. Shortly thereafter, Dollars and Sex was posted on Dr. Adshade's personal homepage. Hello, Marina, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, I really enjoyed your book, and I want to thank you for writing it. It's the book that analyzes intimate relationships from an economic point of view. And this is inherently fascinating, but how does this understanding help people have better relationships or pick better mates?
You know, I think that when I first tell people that I'm an economist and that I work on sex and love and intimate relationships, people are very confused by that, because when they think about economics, they think about markets and they think about, you know, what's happening with trade and the dollar and so on. And so it originally causes confusion, but it doesn't take people very long to realize that a lot of that information that we have about markets translates into the way that we look for our intimate relationships, because really we are operating on a market, even if there's no money exchanging hands. And so taking, you know, the way the economists view markets and applying it to sex and love helps give people a lot of clarity about the system on which they're operating. And so we can take a lot of principles that economists use about how markets function and how we can improve market functionality, and we can apply them to the search for love. And I think that people find that quite helpful.
Now, why does it seem so hard for people to consider that there might be an intersection between love, sex, and money?
Well, you know, it's because I think that, first of all, there's a general misunderstanding about what economics is. I think that people think that economics is primarily about corporations and improving the bottom line and profit, whereas economics really isn't about that. Economics is the study of human behavior under scarcity and really the study of how people behave. You know, there's this whole branch of economics is called behavioral economics. And I think a lot of economists don't really like this, because all economics is behavioral economics. But this isn't really well known that this is the approach we take, unless you've ever taken a first year econ course, especially if you've taken a first year econ course with me, in which you get a lot of this stuff about sex and love, and we talk about marriage and everything in that class. So I think part of it is a misunderstanding about the way that what economics is. Then I think the other part of it is, I think that when people look at love and relationships, they want to believe that it's something magical happening. You know, that when they meet someone, you know, they're finding their soulmate and it's the one, and this happens, you know, organically, and you can't apply any rules to this. People do fundamentally object to that. In one of the reviews in the book, when it came out, the reviewer compared it to the movie Moneyball, right? Where people were talking about how you could game the system in baseball, and how, you know, some of the objection to the economic approach is very much the same, right? You can't really structure this. I'm going to be standing in Starbucks one day, and I'm turn around and talk to the guy behind me, and it's just going to be like magic. Whereas what I'm doing is much more kind of analytical. And I think that that's where people struggle.
Well, I mean, we have this history of the romantic paradigm, which stipulates the only legitimate way to enter into an intimate partnership with somebody is to fall in love with somebody who falls in love with you at the same time. And so that's that romantic imperative. But to what extent do you think our attitudes are also conditioned by patriarchal prohibitions against prostitution?
Oh, prostitution. First of all, I actually don't understand why the patriarchy would be against prostitution. You know, the patriarchy should be all in favor of prostitution. But, you know, it's not even to me, in my mind, the patriarchy's view about prostitution as much as it is the patriarchy's view about women as sexual beings in general. And this is very much at play. And, you know, you would think that in the year 2017, this is not really a big issue, that we've kind of moved beyond this, but we clearly haven't. There's been a number of articles in the media recently that have been based on a book that has recently been written that basically makes the argument that women aren't interested in sex, but women are desperate to marry. Men don't want to marry, but they want to have sex. And so that when we have sex outside of marriage, basically that reduces the price that men are willing to pay to enter into marriage. So it's very much an economic story. And then this is preventing people from marrying. And that argument is fundamentally flawed on a variety of different levels. It's flawed because when we look at who wants to marry, it's men who want to marry. Single men are twice as likely to say it's better to be married to be single than single women. And the second thing is the idea that women only have sex because they want to get resources from men. That kind of thinking is, you know, it's, I know they like to think that's an economic view, right? That every type of transaction is economic, but it's not very true and it's not fair to women. And it's very big distortion of who we are as people. So, there's definitely an element of that that has played out over time. And throughout history, girls have been told this, right? That sex is your resource, you exchange it for marriage. And that has broken down in the last 50 years. And there's clearly people who aren't comfortable with that.
Right. Well, it occurs to me that a possible reason that patriarchy might be against prostitution. And by the way, I'm not trying to promote prostitution, but it's kind of a thin line. If somebody marries somebody for money, to me, that kind of smacks of the same mentality as prostitution. But it seems to me that the patriarchy would want to disempower women because they have this this, you know, facility that men value highly, but we don't want to have to pay for it if we don't have to. Sort of like the Harvey Weinstein attitude, you know, get something for nothing. And so prostitution or the prohibition against it disempowers women, if you look at it that way.
Well, you know, I don't know about that, though, because what the patriarchy really doesn't want is women giving it away for free. The patriarchy wants women to marry. They want women to withhold sex until marriage. And you're right, it is a thin line, right? And so there is very much I don't know if the patriarchy gets to have a party line, but there is very much a party line that that when women have sex outside of marriage, that actually does confer some level of power onto women. And that we should be teaching our daughters to not have sex until they marry, that's part of the natural order. It's a system of controlling women, absolutely a system of controlling women. You know, the thing about prostitution, and this is where I'm struggling with this a little bit, is that before we had a lot of premarital sex, there's always been premarital sex, and people are kidding themselves that they think that their grandparents weren't doing this. They were doing this. But before there was premarital sex, many, many men visited sex workers. Right. You know, Kinsey, when he did his report in the 1940s, found that, you know, on average, about 70% of American men visited a sex worker at some point in their lives. That number is way down. Right. We don't actually know what it is now, but it's a much smaller number than that. And that's because when there wasn't sex outside of marriage, men could use prostitutes. Right. And so I don't know. I think that prostitution served a purpose in the past of keeping the daughters, you know, the daughter's pure until marriage and the proper time when they They guaranteed the support of their husband for the rest of their lives, and then they would give them sex. But prostitution still allowed men to have sex outside of marriage. So I actually think prostitution actually served a purpose historically in preserving that natural order.
Well, I only bring it up because, you know, the title of your book, Dollars and Sex, would just sounds on the surface like it might be about prostitution, which of course it's not. But why would we demonize prostitution if it's serving this good purpose of helping us keep our daughters more pure?
Well, I guess it depends who you think is demonizing it, right?
Well, they make it illegal. They'll send you to jail for it.
They will send you to jail for it. It's true in the United States, but most countries in the world now have legalized it. They won't send you to jail for it in Canada. They won't send you to jail for it in most of Europe, and they will not send you to jail for it in Australia and New Zealand. So it's true that the U.S. is really hanging on to this. And then, of course, there's parts of the U.S. they won't send you to jail for it, right? They won't send you to jail for it in Nevada. They don't want you out on the street, but you can be in a brothel there. I think that I don't know actually about this, about why it is that, you assume that the demonization of prostitution has come from men, but it's very possible it's come from women, right? That I have never seen any discernible difference in objection to prostitution between men and women.
Now, in your book, you start out by making the point, sex makes people happy, and the more sex people have, the happier they are. Sex particularly makes women happy, happier, in fact, than any other activity. That's a fascinating fact.
Yeah, there's all these studies that have been done on happiness and sex. I should just actually point out, and I think that this is worth saying, even though, you know, when I said this originally and when I say this in the book, people who have a certain set of political beliefs kind of latched on to this as evidence of something that it really isn't. And that is that sexual frequency makes people happy. Having multiple sexual partners does not, right? The optimal number of sexual partners for both men and women is one. We're not made happier by having somebody new every week, but we are happy if we have that kind of intimacy in our lives. I don't know that that's really that surprising because, you know, human beings like to be touched, and, you know, this is part of kind of a healthy adulthood. The studies, though, that do this are really interesting, where they take, I love this one particular study that finds this. They took women in Texas. There's a lot of them. It was like 900 women. And they gave them time use diaries to keep track of how they were spending time throughout their day. And then they asked them to rate at that moment how happy they were. And the number one thing that made women happy was sex. And then you look down the list and like right at the bottom of the list is something that I think everybody will find very surprising. And that is spending time with their children. Spending their time with their children makes women is not a happy parts of their day. In fact, commuting home from work is preferred to spending time with their children. It was an interesting study because it really challenges our ideas about how it is that what it is and how what satisfies women in their lives.
Now, you make the point that for both men and women, the optimal number of partners in order to support happiness is one. But then you cite a study in your book that men and women are significantly different when it comes to sexual desire. Statistically, women do not appear to share men's love of variety in sexual partners.
Yeah, you know, since I've written the book, I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. And on top of that, there's been a number of studies that have come out. And one of the things and this is where I think I kind of deviate with my own book, which is fair because scientific knowledge marches on. And that is that when we look at female sexuality from a scientific perspective, a lot of the studies that were done in the past that said that when women were less sexual than men are studies that basically took what makes men happy in terms of sex, and then asks, do these same things make women happy? And the answer is no, they don't, right? You know, number of sexual partners is one of them. It's true, by the way, for men and women, one sexual partner is the maximum happiness, maximizing number of partners. But men will happily have multiple sexual partners in the way that women will not. And in the past, that's been used to say that, well, men are more sexual than women because they don't want to have sex with random people that they don't know. But you know, any woman who's listening to this is going to know why you don't want to have random sex with people that you don't know. First of all, it's just generally not safe for women. Women like to have sex with partners who are willing to invest in them, invest in their own happiness. All of these things are true. It doesn't really make women less sexual. It just makes women making different decisions in order to kind of maximize their well-being. This is something that I'm writing about a lot at the moment. And looking forward into what I'm doing right now, this is actually something that I'm working on. There's the way that we perceive female sexuality. And it matters to me as an economist because taking back to what I said before, this idea of women as asexual beings, being a necessary part of the market to function, as it always has been, is really, really a false assumption.
Right. You know, to what extent do you think that gender differences in sexual desires can be attributed to biology, like hormones, for instance?
I think that the way that men experience sex is different. I think that that's the end of the biology story. I think that much of the differences in behavior that we see between men and women is a socially conditioned. And I have a really great example of this that I'd love to share with you is that in the 19th century, anthropologists went out into the world and they visited pre-industrial societies, a lot of them. There were a lot of them at the time. And then in the 1950s, all of that information was put together in one data set. And so there's about 1,200 pre-industrial societies in that data set. And one of the things anthropologists looked at, not in all of these societies, but in many of them, is whether or not there's a societal belief that women, sorry, that men like sex more than women, that men and women like sex equally, or that women like sex more than men. And what I find really fascinating about that is that when you look at the society level, the overwhelming majority of societies is like 65% of societies think that men and women like sex equally. There are some that say that men like sex more than women, but there are also some that say that women like sex more than men. And I think that that just shows to the extent to which this is so societally conditioned behavior rather than biological behavior. And actually, there's a great American example is that, I don't know if you realize this, but when the Puritans came to America, they also believed that women like sex more than men.
Yeah, no, I'm not questioning that. I'm just wondering about the impact of the differential with regards to testosterone, with regards to oxytocin. I mean, the average healthy male has 25 times the testosterone of the average healthy female, whereas the females have 10 times the oxytocin. It seems to me that these are pretty powerful factors.
Well, no, I don't think that's that simple, right? I know, first of all, I don't know that testosterone may be related to sex drive in men, but I don't think it is related to sex drive in women. But you'd have to ask. There's many psychologists, biological psychologists who are working on these issues. Those would be the people to ask those questions. Oxytocin, though, is a different issue. First of all, I don't know that that's true. But there's other hormones that men have that serve the same function. So women, it's true, oxytocin is the pair bonding. So just in case your listeners don't know this, oxytocin is the hormone that people form with each other when they form a serious pair bond. It's not the hormone that you get when you meet someone and you're like crazy about them and you can't sleep and they're driving you crazy because you just want to be with them so much. It's not that. It's the hormone that you get after a couple of months where you just feel like you just can't live without this person. It's the hormone that's most related to romantic love, right? So it's true that there's maybe more oxytocin in women, but men have vasopressin, which serves exactly the same function. So as great as it would be just to go out and measure hormones and go, here we go, evidence of this, I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true, scientifically true.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought that testosterone was the hormone that gave rise to or made sexual desire that much more insistent, which seems to be the case relative between men and women. But maybe, I don't know.
It might make it more insistent for men, but it doesn't mean that it's going to make it more insistent for women.
Well, they say that women are horniest when they're ovulating, which is when their testosterone is highest.
Well, then you know something about this that I don't know. I do know that when women go through menopause, they have more testosterone. And I don't think that anybody's saying that women are getting hornier as they get older, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know.
In order to say that, we'd have to admit that they were horny in the first place, which many people are just not willing to admit. I find this really interesting topic. And I think it's something that as a society, we need to spend a lot more time thinking about, you know, and it takes us back to the idea of prostitution. The reason why we need to have this understanding about sexuality is because we may be opposed to prostitution, but as a society, we're definitely not opposed to women exchanging sex for resources. In fact, we encourage it. Many, many people think this is the natural order. Women withhold sex until marriage because withholding sex until marriage makes it possible for them to exchange sex for a house, you know, a husband who has an income. That is actually part of our order. I don't know if you've, I have a TED talk. I don't know if you've seen it. It has a very provocative title, Your Mother Is Not a Whore. And I actually address this issue is that we want to think that the only reason our mothers had sex is because our fathers supported them, because God forbid they should have actually wanted to do that. And we really do. This is so ingrained in our society that women should be exchanging sex for resources. And really, the idea is that all women are prostitutes on some level. And that's what I would actually like to spend a little bit more time moving forward, thinking about.
Yeah, no, I think that's fascinating, and I look forward to looking at to listening to that TED talk and to also reading your next book.
Oh, I'd love to talk about my next book, actually.
Okay, well, just before we get there, let's talk. Traditionally, economics has always played a major role in the institution of marriage, right?
It has. And you know what? In fact, in many ways, economics has played a more important role than in the past than it has now. You know, in the past, marriage was really about two people coming together for the purposes of production, right? You know, when economists started thinking about this in the 1970s, you know, particularly with Gary Becker, he really felt that marriage was like a firm, and the firm you bring together, you know, people who have different skill sets, so that they can maximize the output of the firm. And so, from the family perspective, you know, historically, it's being a woman who had skills in taking care of children and taking care of the home, and man who was good at earning the workforce. And this was always the way because men had traditionally earned more than women, because traditional labor rewarded brawn, you know, upper body strength, and men have that, right? And so traditionally, that's really what the family was: two very different people coming together for the purposes of production. You know, which is largely children in a home. That has broken down significantly. And it didn't just start 50 years ago, it started 100 years ago. And over the last 100 years, marriage has really been about something else. It's been about people coming together for the purposes of love and companionship. Economists call this consumption compatibilities, you know, consuming things together as a couple. And so really, marriage is way less economic than it was in the past, but it doesn't mean it's not subject to economic forces.
Okay, let's talk about your next book. Where are you headed?
So this is a perfect segue because this is exactly where I'm headed. The next book that I'm working on is taking where we are now in terms of marriage. You know, I think that as a society, we're feeling slightly lost on this topic. Whenever we talk about marriage, there's quite a bit of hand-wringing on the idea that marriage isn't what it used to be. People aren't marrying as much as they used to. People are marrying later. Marriages are not always lasting. And this causes us consternation as a society. And what I think that we've lost in all of this is the realization that individuals, particularly young individuals, people who are millennials, for example, they're not hand-wringing over marriage, but they are worrying. And the thing that they're worrying about is this, is that they're saying to themselves, you know, I would like to be married. People actually want to be married. And most people will marry at some point in their life, despite the fact that, you know, marriage is not what it used to be. And so for millennials, they're thinking, I want to be married, But I don't really know what that looks like for me because they're not looking for the same marriage that their parents have. They're not looking for the same marriage that their grandparents have, or that really people have had throughout long periods of time. They're looking for their own thing, their own individual approach to marriage. And so this is what I'm working about. I'm looking at the individualization of marriage, and the movement away from marriage as being an socially constructed idea where we have very specific ideas about gender roles, to marriage being something else. And that something else is really up to the individual. So that's what I'm working on. It's more forward-looking, more futuristic to look at marriage, and see where we might think about marriage moving into the future, because there's zero time point spent working on worrying about where marriage used to be and how come we can't get back there. You know, this horse is out of the stable. We are never going back to traditional marriage.
So, in other words, you're talking about the future of marriage being a more customized, personalized, union.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this takes us down a path towards, you know, what I call the deinstitutionalization of marriage, where, you know, marriage is no longer dictated to us by our government or by society, that we get to choose it as our own form. You know, you might refer to this as the post-marriage society, but you know, there is marriage in the post-marriage society. It's just not marriage as we thought of it as in the past. And that is, I think, the direction we're going in. And so I think for young people, you know, people who are, you know, in their early 20s to kind of mid-30s, this is very much on their mind, right? Not, you know, it's not just hardcore, what do I, who finding somebody. It's what do I want to find? And it's not just single people who are thinking it. Married people are thinking it too. They're asking themselves, is this type of marriage I want? And what kind of marriage do I want in the future?
You know, there's so much we could talk about, and we've run out of time. You know, I would love to have a much more developed discussion about what are people looking for in marriage going forward, and what are you finding. And so maybe we can have you on the show at some point in the future when you've done more research or written your other book,
I would love that.
and we can talk about that. But there's so much we could explore, but we have run out of time. And I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website so that they can find out about your work, so they can find out about your TED Talk, so they can find out about you. And that is marinaadshade.com. And I think I'm going to spell that for people because it's all one word. Marina is obvious. Adshade, Adshade. So there's two A's in the middle of that, marinaadshade.com. And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you like via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we have been visiting with Dr. Marina Adshade, author of the book Dollars and Sex: How Economics Influences Sex and Love. And Marina, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's been very interesting speaking with you.
And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into the Pathways program, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.FM on Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled DIVINATION.com, as well as via iTunes and Google Podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Dr. Marina Adshade and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.